The air soothed her bare, burn-ravaged back. She drew in a cool breath, tilted her face to the smog-smeared stars. Somewhere pots clanged, and a car backfired, and drunken young men yelled in the night. She thought of a girl with raven hair bent over the open hatch of the car, her almond-shaped face, sweet and simple, the blood spurting from her carotid. "The man you stuck me with," Candy said. "My fellow diner. The guy's a psychopath." "Yes," came back the multitude of voices. "But he's my psychopath." 30. Someone's idea of a library. Two dogs, 13 guards, 2 snipers, 1 doctor, and Dex. In his room late that night, Evan considered his next move. He'd been building a mental blueprint of the facility, biding his time for the right moment to escape. Now that Renee had brought in more men, Evan wanted to know more. Not just about the men, but about Renee. This inexhaustible supply of guards raised further questions. What was Renee really up to here? Had some of the potential escape routes been compromised? Evan looked at the fireplace, made up his mind. Crossing the room, he eased the sliding door back. Knocking out 2 of the security cameras meant he could move unseen by the balcony, fireplace, and desk. From the balcony, he gazed across at the barn. The big door was rolled back. Inside, 2 of the narcos practiced hand-to-hand on a wrestling mat laid down in front of the vehicles. They were skilled fighters, acquainted with martial arts, throws and kicks and deflections. Several others rimmed the periphery, pounding the mat and shouting encouragement. This time around, Renee had wisely hired not just gunmen, but fighters familiar with the down and dirty. Shivering against the cold, Evan stepped back into the bedroom, but left the sliding glass door wide open. Climbing into bed, he pretended to toss and turn, landing himself just off screen. Then he shoved a pillow under the covers at the periphery of the hidden camera's view where his shoulder might be. A chilly current kicked up, the open slider pulling a stream of air into the room. He waited at the edge of the bed, staring over at the ceiling vent, straining his ears. When the halogenated ether hissed through, he rolled over and buried his face in a pillow. He felt the draft across his back, the gas moving past him, filling the balcony, dissipating in the night air. He waited until the hissing stopped, and then waited 20 minutes more. Breathing grew hard, the feather pillows trapping his breath. But he managed. Finally, he lifted his face. Awake. He moved carefully around the foot of the bed and walked lightly into the bathroom, keeping to the strip of concrete next to the sink. With his toe, he snared the edge of the trash can liner. He fluffed it open, filled it with water, carried the bulging bag back into the bedroom and over to the hearth. He poked a hole in the bottom of the liner and used the bursting bag as a watering can, flooding the cedar logs. They popped and hissed, giving off smoke that the chute suctioned up. The fire died down to a cherry glow, the logs disintegrating into ash. Evan retrieved his hiking boots from where he'd placed them by the footboard and used them to stamp out the remaining embers. Then he moved them from his hands to his feet, lacing them up tightly. After waiting for the flue to cool, he pushed it open, wide enough to fit his shoulders, barely. Time for a recon mission. Sitting on the fireplace, he leaned back and slid his head and torso through the flue. It was tight, the walls crowding in, the stink of wet ash clogging his throat. He wiggled up to a standing position. Past the vent, the chimney opened up a bit. That made it easy for him to shove his way up off the floor, using his forearms and the tread of his boots to push outward against the scorched brick. He moved in lurches, a few inches at a time. Every foot or so, he'd stop and listen. He'd pulled a similar Santa ploy once in a chimney in the Czech Republic, squirming his way between floors to eavesdrop on a conversation. but given the thick walls of the old chalet, he had no luck hearing anything aside from his own breathing. He made slow, painful progress. Grit caked his cheeks, crammed itself beneath his nails. The glow of his bedroom vanished underfoot, leaving him in absolute darkness. After a time, he saw a spill of golden light from a room above. He wormed his way up toward the next floor. His calves cramped, his thighs burning. He was unable to wipe off the sweat tickling his brow, so he blinked hard, contorting his face. He couldn't look up to gauge his progress because flakes of ash fell down into his eyes, but he sensed the light growing stronger, sweeping across his shoulders. At last his hand made contact with a lip in the flue. After so many tentative climbing holds, the firm grip felt reassuring. He grabbed the lip with both hands, put the soles of his boots against the wall beneath, wedged his back against the opposite wall, and rested. He wiped his forehead on his sleeves, and then took stock. He'd arrived at the edge of a shaft angled down to a fireplace on the fourth floor. The log holder below was stacked high with unlit cedar logs. Before scouting the room, he wanted to check what was above. Gathering his strength, he pulled himself farther up the flue, put his boots on the lip he'd just been gripping, and strained to reach above him. Two thick bars, coated with soot and welded into place, blocked the way up. He stood there, balanced above the fourth floor in the guts of the building, breathing away his disappointment. There'd be no going up and out onto the roof, which would have afforded him an ideal vantage to pinpoint the locations of Renee's men. But all hopes for intel gathering weren't dashed. He could still make it down through the fireplace beneath him and into that fourth floor room. And if there was one thing Jack had taught him, it was that there was useful information to be had everywhere. He led with his arms, like going down a playground slide face first. Halfway down the shaft, his grease-slicked hold failed and he tumbled into the fireplace, his shoulder smacking into the stack of cedar logs. A crooked, upside-down view told him the room was empty. It was a study. Careful not to upset the pyre of logs further, he eased his way out of the fireplace, emerging into the room. Using a towel slung over the stack of extra logs on the hearth, he wiped his hands and the soles of his boots. Then he stepped tentatively onto an elaborate Pakistani rug. He checked behind him to make sure his boots left no track. His shirt and jeans remained filthy. He'd have to take care not to brush up against anything. Brass sconces painted dim sprays of light on the walls. Dark bookshelves towered on either side of an imposing desk. An ergonomic chair sat cocked and waiting. Casting a glance over his shoulder at the closed door, Evan moved across the room. He pulled the chair out and checked the wall beneath the desk, confirming that the electrical outlets were indeed standard North American. Then he turned his focus to the file drawer. Its thick, shiny lock did not look factory installed. There was no give when he tugged the handle. The desk surface was spotless and bare, save a bouquet of pens and pencils sprouting from a leather cup and a pair of slender reading glasses resting on a desk mat. No letter opener. Evan slid open the top drawer. Nothing inside but a few paper clips, a roll of scotch tape, and a scattering of file tabs. The other drawers were empty. The lack of personal items seemed in keeping with Renee's obsessive use of his DNA privacy spray. He went to great lengths to keep his identity hidden, to leave not a trace of himself behind. I rent this life. What is mine is hidden away down a rabbit hole. A necessity with which Evan was all too familiar. He knew he was living on borrowed time by now. If they hadn't already figured out that he wasn't in his room, they would at any minute. He made the choice to keep looking. The key was finding something before they showed up, something he could use. He quickened his search. The trash can held only a balled-up junk mail envelope. He uncrumpled it and checked the address label. It had been mailed to the Chalet Savoir Faire in Maine. Maine? Another piece of disinformation? He doubted it. No one would expect him to be snooping through trash cans on the fourth floor. He wadded up the envelope again and dropped it back into the bin. As he rose, his face came level with the spectacles folded on the blotter. Something on one of the rectangular lenses caught his eye. He tilted his face to peer at it. A fingerprint-sized smudge marked the glass. Evan worked swiftly. After positioning the reader's face up on the mat, he snapped a pencil in half, then bent a paperclip open and used the tip to scrape the lead, letting graphite dust fall onto the lens. Once the dust coated the lens, he blew it gently off. Graphite particles held only where the oils of Renee's finger had touched the glass, forming two-thirds of a fingerprint. Grabbing scotch tape, Evan stripped a 3-inch piece off the roll and pressed one end of the sticky side carefully over the print. The graphite dust clung to the tape, the fingerprint lifting away from the lens. Evan folded the tape over itself, sticky side to sticky side, sealing in the fingerprint to preserve it. Then he stripped off another short length of tape and adhered the fossilized print to the inside of his arm above the elbow, protected from friction and hidden from view. Next, he lifted the top drawer, pulling it off the tracks and setting it on the blotter. He felt in the space where the drawer had been in case Renee had taped the key on the underside of the wood. No luck. He tried the same with the drawers to the side. Nothing. Stepping back, he assessed the dusty bookshelves. They were filled with venerable hardbacks stripped of their covers, the spines forming fashion statement stripes of faded gray and olive green. It seemed more like someone's idea of a library than an actual library. Evan's attention caught on a gap in the dust on the second shelf, a thin slot where one of the books had recently been removed. He walked over and plucked the book from the shelf, smiling at the title. He cracked the cover of the Robert Louis Stevenson classic, and a key fell out, landing softly on the carpet. It fit the file drawer. Crouched, he tugged the drawer open. It was crammed with files, each tab featuring a different name. He thumbed through the first one. Bank account details, a social security number. The photograph, paper-clipped to the back of the folder, sent a prickle across the nape of his neck. It was a middle-aged man lying unconscious and naked on the bed downstairs. The same bed Evan had slept in the past few nights. Shaking off his discomfort, he continued to flip through the files. So many men and women had gone through Renee's operation before Evan. Every mini-dossier contained financial information. Clipped to each back cover was a photograph of a different naked, drugged victim positioned on the bed. He'd figured that Renee had run his scheme a time or two before. But seeing the crammed rows of file tabs, Evan grasped just how routine and efficient the process was. From what he could piece together, Renee had extorted over $300 million from these people. The rear file tab had not a name, but a question mark. Evan pulled it free and opened it. A printout of the katana sword on the auction website. His Privatbank AG account information, a fingerprint card, and a photograph of him sprawled unconscious across the mattress in his bedroom cell, just like those who had preceded him. He studied the picture of himself, emotions moving in him like dark currents. Then he tore the photo and the fingerprint card into tiny bits and pushed them down a heating vent beneath the desk. Behind him, he heard the door creak open. Manny shouted, "I got him!" Keeping his back turned, Evan rose. He gripped the broken pencil. Footsteps pounded the hall. "Turn around," Manny said. Evan did. "It's about time," he said. Manny stood just inside the threshold, his less lethal shotgun aimed not at Evan's face, but at his crotch. "Drop the pencil." Evan eyed the angle of the barrel and dropped the pencil. Nando eased through the doorway, and then the fresh recruits poured past him and spread across the room's perimeter. shotguns with neon stocks all around. They waited. Heavier footsteps announced Dex's approach. He broke through the ring and contemplated Evan, snake eyes peering through an expressionless mask. Renee entered a step behind him. He took in the open file drawer, anger lurking behind that plastic grin. "I like a challenge," he said. "But you're testing my patience," Evan said, "and you're testing mine." He stepped back until he felt the desk pressing against his hamstrings. Renee gave a nod to the men who closed in on Evan from three sides, leading with their shotguns. Evan looked for any break or opportunity, but there would be none tonight. Dex strode up to him, a needle flashing in his hand. A well-placed smack spun Evan into the desk, and he felt the pinch above his shoulder blade. Warmth spread beneath his skin, his muscles jellying. As he slipped to the floor, he caught a tilted glance of Dex peering down at him, his head cocked, his expression something between hunger and curiosity. 31. A Hard Man. Evan awoke naked on the floor of his bedroom, blinking into the harsh light of morning. His head throbbed. His mouth was chalky, his throat drier than it had ever been. A single breath led to a coughing fit. He started to rise when a ring of fire ignited around his neck. His body slapped the floor, his muscles twitching against the rustic oak planks. He managed to fight one hand up to the blazing nerves of his throat and felt a metal band clamped into place. A shock collar. Behind him, he heard Manny laugh. "This is gonna make our job easier, S.A. No more getting our arms all tired holding up the shotgun and shit." Evan pushed himself onto all fours, managed to get a wobbly foot down beneath him. His neck caught fire once more, nerves burning up through his face. His chest struck the floor again. Convulsing, he couldn't tell if the shock was still running or if he was just feeling the after effects of the current sizzling through his skin. When his vision unblurred, he watched Manny turning the transmitter over in his hand, admiring it. "This thing is great." "Take it easy," Nando said. "Renee'll be furioso if you fry his brain." "It's not gonna fry his brain. People use it all the time. For chimps in labs, at the lower setting." Manny grinned. "Boss did say to put a little more oomph in it." Evan shoved himself up again, wiped drool from his lower lip. He sneaked a glance at the inside of his arm, saw the tab of scotch tape preserving Renee's fingerprint stuck there, hidden from view. "No breakfast cart this morning?" The next shock flipped him onto his side. Through the static, he heard Manny laughing. "Give me that." Nando wrestled the transmitter away. "It's time for his exercise." Manny walked over and kicked Evan's feet. "Hurry up and get dressed, or I take back the transmitter." Evan trudged across the snow-dusted ground, scratching at his skin beneath the shock collar. The new guard in the tower watched him not with binoculars, but through the scope of a dedicated marksman rifle. It wouldn't have the range of the sniper rifles in the mountains, but the right one in the right hands could be effective to 600 or even 700 meters. When Evan paused to identify the gun from its silhouette, the guard reached into his pocket. Evan barely had time to wonder what he was doing before countless needle tips jabbed into his neck. He lost his legs again, snow against his cheek, crusting the hollow of one eye. He lay there, panting for breath. There'd be no getting used to the shock level. So the tower guard was also armed with a transmitter for Evan's collar. And God knew who else. Evan pulled himself up and staggered for the tree line, keeping his gaze low. He'd thrown on multiple layers again. He felt bulky beneath two shirts and two sweaters, ballooning at the midsection like Tweedledee. Once he was hidden by the evergreens, he sat with his back to a tree and groped around the collar. Contact points rimmed the inside, metal prongs grouped in twos, the rounded tips jutting into his skin. His thumb found a notch near the back where the band snapped into place. No keyhole that he could discern. Perhaps the release was remote-controlled as well. The collar had little give. There'd be no moving the contact points off the skin. It was tight enough that swallowing was hard, like having a peach pit at the base of his throat that would not go down. Rising, he hiked up the gradual slope of the northern face, wanting to get a better look at the entire valley. He crested a bulge in the mountainside and assessed his options. From this vantage, it was clear that the western and eastern sides of the range were too steep to be traversed. Cliff-like runs of shale would prevent any ascent, while simultaneously leaving him exposed. He doubted that Renee had bothered to place snipers on those ends of the range. One shooter to the north and one to the south, aided by the eyes of the guard in the tower, could contain Evan in the valley. Since the northern slope provided the best route to freedom, Renee had positioned the stronger sniper there, which meant that when Evan made a break, he'd head up the opposite mountain. Wanting a better view of the southern side, he hiked higher up the northern range now. This was his last chance to recon. He was leaving tonight. Tomorrow, Renee was planning to force him to empty out his bank account, which was unacceptable for a host of reasons, not least of which were the ramifications of wiring money from his account without his own meticulous encryption procedures in place. Charles Van Sciver and an array of the most powerful search software programs ever created were working around the clock for the faintest trace of the Nowhere Man to blip onto the radar. One click of the mouse would make Evan disposable to Renee and put Van Sciver onto his scent at the same time. He was unwilling to deal with either complication. Not with Allison Siegler and the boy out there waiting. The thought sharpened his purpose, quickened his step. He fell into a rhythm, making decent time. The sun dominated a blue and cloudless sky, warming him enough to break a sweat despite the temperature. He stopped at intervals to eye the mountain across from him, mentally charting courses and backup courses, noting potential positions the sniper might take and the blind zones of those respective positions. The third commandment. Master your surroundings. He'd just started up again when a loud crack announced itself, and a football-sized chunk of bark flew out of the tree trunk to his side. Evan halted. His breath wisped from his mouth once, twice. He took a small step forward, and another rifle report sounded. Wood splintered overhead, and then a heavy bough rushed down, crashing a few feet in front of him. He paused again. Oriented upslope, trying to zero in on the sniper's position. He stepped to the left. This time he saw the muzzle flare an instant before the round kicked up dirt to the side of his boot. The sniper was herding him down the slope toward the chalet. Knowing he was clearly visible in the scope, Evan raised a hand. Got it. Turning around, he started down the mountain. He kept on in the direction the sniper had indicated, moving swiftly. Once he'd crossed a ripple in the mountainside, he knew he'd moved out of range of the scope. Rather than continuing down, he carved along the hillside, keeping to the dense trees. The pine air tingled in his mouth, his throat. At last he circled to the rear of the barn. Bellying down behind the tree line, he peered through the trunks at the back door about 50 yards away. Two of the narcos patrolled the barn at intervals, the Dobermans trotting alongside. Evan watched and timed them. In the tower beyond, the guard scanned the woods with his scope, holding his radio to his face with increasing frequency and agitation. A few minutes later, a contingent of 3 guards exited the barn and jogged into the forest to the north. Though it wasn't yet dusk, they wore night vision goggles pushed up high on their foreheads in case the hunt went long. Evan watched them go, then waited for the patrol to rotate one more time. When they passed, he broke cover and darted for the barn. The first 10 paces left him in full view of the tower, but the guard there stayed focused on the northern slope, rifle scope pressed to his face. Evan sprinted for the cover of the barn, at last falling under its shadow. The rear door was unlocked. He cracked it, peering inside, wind whistling across the back of his neck. The G-wagons and the Rolls were parked among a scattering of mechanics tools. The gear lockers rimming the interior sported hefty padlocks. Though he could see no one, he heard the echo of voices somewhere inside. Footsteps crunched the fresh snow along the adjacent side of the barn. The patrol returning. The breeze carried the sound of the dogs panting, and then plumes of breath wisped around the corner a few feet off the ground. Evan slid into the barn, eased the door closed. The open space was broken only by a small box of an office that was little more than two thin walls and a flimsy door in the corner. Through the interior window he spotted movement, so he hit the floor and lay still, breathing grease fumes. Cold air drafted beneath the rear door, blowing against his face. He heard the patrol approaching and tensed in case the guards detoured inside. The sounds grew near, and then shadows dotted the gap beneath the door. Broad blocks for the men's boots, flickering spots for the Doberman's paws. They passed. Evan rolled behind the nearest G-wagon, then rose to a crouch and peered through the vehicle's windows into the office. All he could make out now was a sturdy arm leaning against a cabinet, the back of the hand tattooed with a too wide grin. A voice carried over. "What is he planning?" It sounded like Nando. He heard Despy answer from somewhere in the office. "I don't know." Nando again. "Will he wire the money tomorrow?"
"He won't tell me."
"What does he tell you?"
"Nothing. He tells me nothing. He's a hard man."
"Maybe you're not good enough. Maybe we need to replace you with your sister."
If Despy replied, Evan couldn't hear it. His eyes picked across the scattered gear, finally lighting on what he was looking for. A car jack. The one he'd spotted Samuel using 2 days earlier to prop up the Rolls-Royce. When the handle was turned, the scissor jack cranked open into a diamond, but when closed, it was relatively thin. Thin enough, he hoped, to hide beneath his bulky sweaters and smuggle back into his room. Given that Manny and Nando no longer came within 20 feet of him, he had a decent shot. He just had to sneak back into the woods, circle around, and then emerge casually from the tree line. But first he had to get his hands on the jack. It rested in the open just beyond the hood of a Mercedes, 3 steps onto the wrestling mat. If he made a move for it, he'd be briefly but completely exposed.
"We send a man by her apartment now and then. Watch her watering her tomatoes on the balcony," Nando was saying in the office. "Beautiful hair. Just like yours."
Despy's reply was muffled by the walls. Evan crept from cover. 1 step, setting his boot down silently, rolling from heel to toe. Another brought him onto the blue rubber mat. He leaned over, reaching for the jack. His fingertips had just reached the metal when the door flew open, and Despy filled the frame, her face burning. Dex and Nando remained behind her in the office, though their gazes were not yet lifted. Despy stared at Evan, trying to process his being here. Crouched over the jack, he stared back. Her expression held a mix of dark emotions. It was unclear which would win out. Keeping his eyes locked on hers, Evan started to retreat behind the hood of the G-wagon, moving out of Dex and Nando's view. That's when he heard the rear door open behind him. Claws scrabbled against the concrete floor. The Dobermans erupted in snarls. He was hidden between the 2 big SUVs, but not for long. Despy remained unmoving as a statue in the doorway, her lips slightly parted, one hand still raised from when it had shoved open the door, her eyes flared wide. She blinked, swallowed hard. He held up his hands and nodded at her.
"Go ahead."
The dog's barks grew louder. On the far side of the G-wagon, the narcos shouted in Spanish. He sensed movement behind Despy, Dex and Nando drawn toward the commotion. Evan gestured at her more firmly.
"Do it."
She raised her arm, pointed at him. It took 2 tries for her voice to work.
"Here, He's here!
She'd done an admirable job conveying panic. Nando knocked her aside, barreling past her, his heavy coat flicking high in his wake. Already he held the transmitter aloft, pinching the button with his thumb. Evan registered barely a half-thought. Oh, fuck! And then the current surged into him, radiating through his head and torso. Convulsing on the floor, he sensed the dog's snapping jaws inches from his face. Confused, they barked and snarled. Humans weren't supposed to twitch like that. As they strained their leads, their handlers leaned back to keep them from tearing into him. A command rang across the concrete from the far side of the barn. Off! The Dobermans waddled back a few steps and sat, panting around wide grins. Ropes of saliva necklaced the sleek, dark fur of their chests. Evan rolled his head on the rubber mat, catching an upside-down view of Renee silhouetted in the opening made by the pushed-back barn door. He said, "You don't stop, do you?" Evan made a noise intended to convey assent. "No more walks for you, no more exercise, and no more time." "Until what?" Evan's words came out fuzzy. "Until you wire me my money. Open of business tomorrow." Renee continued in and stopped behind the Dobermans, stroking their heads. "Good boys, good, good boys." He fished treats from his pocket and rewarded them. "Do you like dogs?" Renee asked Evan. Evan coughed hoarsely into the mat. "It's their loyalty that gets me," Renee observed, "purer than love. You know the joke. Lock your dog and your wife in the trunk of your car for 24 hours. When you open it, which one is happy to see you?" The Dobermans bared their teeth. Their marble eyes stayed locked on Evan, who'd managed to shove himself to a standing position, his hands on his knees. The skin of his neck prickled, angry and raw. Behind Nando, Despy caught his eye, her forehead twisted in anguish. He looked down quickly, not wanting to give away their rapport. "Put him in his room," Renee said to Dex. Then, as he breezed past Evan, "Be showered in time for dinner." Evan shook his head, trying to clear the static. Too late, he realized he was smirking. Renee halted. His face reddened. "Is something amusing, Evan?" "No." "Why are you grinning?" "Because I get it now." "Get what?" Renee waited, growing impatient. "What do you think you get?" Evan squared to him. "I think you want to be a psychopath, Renee. But you're not. I think what you are is lonely. I think the only way you can get guests to your dinner table is by paying them or forcing them. I think you believe you can buy your way out of your misery. And that isn't amusing. It's profoundly fucking pathetic." Renee drew his head back, his chin doubling. His flush deepened, color seeping unevenly along the nipped and tucked lines of his face. Then his expression hardened, the vulnerability clamped behind a mask of controlled rage. He walked across the barn, through the rolling door, and out into the blazing white. Evan was watching him fade into the lightly falling snow, when another jolt of the collar cut his legs out from under him. 32. Ready. Evan sat cross-legged on the floor, his shoulders bowed. He hadn't gotten the carjack. Without the carjack, he couldn't break out of his room. If he couldn't break out of his room, he couldn't help Allison Siegler and the boy. Evan was down to his last few hours. He reminded himself how much he could get done in a few hours. One way or another, he was getting out of this room, and out of this chalet. He would fight his way over the snowy peak of the mountain, leaving a trail of bright arterial blood in his wake. A noise issued overhead, startling him from his thoughts. The hissing gas had come so much earlier than usual, the sun not yet kissing the western horizon. This was his punishment for laying Renee bare in the barn. To bed without dinner. Renee was done taking chances. He was going to knock Evan out and revive him at the deadline in a few hours to make the wire transfer. Holding his breath, Evan rushed to the sliding glass door and threw it wide. He stepped outside, but the clean air quickly turned bitter, the gas being drawn through the open door. Rushing back inside, he lay on the bed and buried his face in a pillow. His breathing grew heavy. A wave of grogginess came on. He fought to stay conscious. The hissing finally stopped, but he kept his face buried, waiting for the air to clear. That's when he felt the vibration. The roam zone beneath the mattress. The boy calling him. Another vibration signaled the second ring. Evan lifted his face. He could still taste the halogenated ether riding the back of his throat. Third ring. He rolled off the bed, his kneecaps banging the floorboards, shoved an arm beneath the mattress, came out with the wrecked roam zone. The high-power density lithium-ion battery was still going strong. The kid's number guttered across the cracked screen. Just in time, Evan thumbed the green icon and held the phone to his face. Somehow the circuit board held together.
"Hello?" "It's me."
Same voice as before, but even more hushed. The connection was bad, static fuzzing the line. Evan swallowed hard. His head was swimming from the gas he'd inhaled, but he fought his thoughts back online. "Are you okay?"
"I don't know. I'm trapped here. There's never enough food. I don't want this life. I didn't ask for it. I didn't ask for any of it."
"What are they doing to you?"
"That's not even the worst part," the boy said.
"What is?"
"I'm nothing here. That's the worst part."
His hushed voice held a kind of awe.
"No one cares. If you don't exist, then it doesn't matter, right?"
"No, that's not right. Look, listen."
Evan blinked hard, rubbed his eyes, forging through the muddle in his head.
"Whatever's being done to you, it's wrong. It's not your fault. And you're not the only one."
"I know what happens to other kids,"
the boy said.
"I see it even. But when it happens to you, it feels like you're the first person it's happened to in the whole world."
"I know."
Evan felt emotion pressing at the back of his face.
"You're resourceful. Scrappy. Like I was."
The ether had loosened his inhibitions. He heard his words drawl, knew he was saying more than he should. He was supposed to be the nowhere man, armored in his role as savior and hero, indomitable and distant and safe. But right now, he felt like none of those things. The static grew to a roar, and for a moment Evan thought the call had dropped. But then the kid's voice came back in.
"Can't talk about it."
"Why not?"
"I'm scared to. It's not safe."
A wet breath. Evan took a breath of his own, held it. Then,
"Can you get out?"
"Nowhere to get to."
"Find help."
"No one can help me."
"Can't you run away and go to the cops?"
"No. I need you."
Locked on the third floor of a guarded chalet at the base of a snowy valley, Evan nodded.
"I'll get to you," he said. "I'm coming soon."
In the silence, he could hear the boy breathing across the phone. Finally, the kid said,
"I have to go now. I'll try and call back if I can."
"When you do," Evan said, "I'll be ready."
33. The Inexpressible. Parking level 3. Submerged in a sea of crimson. Evan is underwater, trapped inside his own locked-down body, his lips stitched shut, drowning in Jack's blood. Jack ripples across from him like some hard-bitten merman. His arm is raised. The fine hairs of his forearm waver like tendrils of seaweed. His finger points at Evan.
You.
Evan strains and struggles. His muscles bulge but cannot move. Paralyzed. For the first time, he lifts his gaze to brave Jack's stare directly. Jack's eyes are not what Evan expects. They are filled not with accusation, but with love. Yet the finger still points, and Evan realizes, not you did this, but you hold the key. Evan feels it roiling inside him, years of pent-up anguish and guilt and grief, an age-old whirlpool of despair. It is every feeling he had consigned to the depths of his gut, every unspoken word he has packed down his throat. It reaches a vomit pitch, and he understands that it will no longer be denied. Acid burns up his esophagus and claws crab-like into the back of his mouth. His lips strain at the sutures, and then rip free. It breaks through. A howl cracked out of the hidden core of himself, expressing the inexpressible. It says, "Help me." 34. What it is you do. Evan bolted awake, aware of a presence in the dark room. He'd meant only to lie down for a moment after the boy's phone call. But the lingering effects of the sleeping gas must have put him out briefly. Someone stood at the end of the bed. Was he out of time? He sat up, blinking rapidly to stimulate his night vision, the shock collar shifting painfully around his neck. The form emerged from the darkness, curved and feminine beneath a thick bathrobe from the spa. She parted her robe. Beneath it, one arm clutched something to her stomach. Drawing near, she sent the object on the edge of the bed, out of view of the remaining surveillance camera. The car jack. "Make them pay," Despy whispered. He stared at the slender tool indenting the sheets. "You were trying to get it," she said. "I don't know what for, but you have it now. So do what it is you do." "I can't take this. If he finds out, he'll what? Hurt me?" She gave a quiet little laugh. "Hurt me more? You. Your family. You have too much to lose. As do you," she said. "You have 1 hour until he comes for you." He felt it then. The swirling blackness at the heart of himself, the inner whirlpool from his dream. "Don't help me." "No. You don't get to tell me this. You don't get to decide." Evan stared at the car jack, wanting it desperately. For himself, yes, but even more for Allison Siegler, for the boy waiting for his help. He said, "But he'd kill you. Your family. You can't take that risk. I can't, or you can't." He thought of Jack's eyes, conveying urgency and love, his finger pointing at Evan through the crimson sea. "You hold the key." "I can't," he said. "I can't be responsible for something that could hurt you." She gave a laugh that held no humor. "We don't get to choose that. That's part of being human." He looked down at his hands, clenched loosely in his lap. "You can't do it on your own," Despy said. She studied him, one eyebrow arched in an unspoken question. Her robe hung open, showing the slope of her divine belly. Venus at the bath. She was waiting to knot the sash again and leave, either with the car jack or without. He looked down at it there on the sheets.
if he accepted it. He had to accept all the responsibility that came with it. He looked back up at Despi. He nodded.
35. Into the Snowy White. In a single shirt and sweater, Evan felt less bulky than on his previous excursions. He had to be, for what he was about to do. He stepped out onto the balcony. The moonless sky was black as pitch, broken only by flurries of snowflakes that swept through the welded bars. A trio of guards clustered around the fire outside the barn, warming their hands, Kalashnikovs resting at their sides. They did not look over. He had a limited window of time out here in the dead of night. His gloveless hands already felt cold, and the more numb they got, the more useless they'd be. Raising the scissor jack, he jammed it between two of the bars. Then he cranked the handle. The jack expanded, irising open with enough force to lift a 4,000-pound car. The bars bowed. Evan kept rotating the handle, leaning into the effort. The sounds of creaking metal intensified. The resistance grew stronger, his forearms straining. And then two of the bars gave way at the welded joints, popping free. One struck him lightly in the chest and clanged to the floor of the balcony. The other plummeted into the snowy white. He shot a glance at the guards by the barn, but they were telling stories, focused on the flickering light of the fire, not on the darkness beyond. Sticking his head through the gap, Evan looked down, but the fallen bar was lost to the white bank below, the thin black slot in the ground already being layered over. Onward. He squeezed his head and one leg through the hole, then drew his body carefully behind him. The bag of Doritos crinkled in his waistband where he'd tucked them. The Rome Zone phone bulged in his pocket, awaiting the kid's next call. Despite the extra baggage, Evan made it through the gap. The bars provided a ready grip from the outside. The only problem was how cold they were, sticking to his palms. When he adjusted his grasp, he left some skin behind. He lowered himself down into a squat, his ass hanging in thin air, his heels cantilevered off the outside edge of the balcony. He checked the guards, firmed his fists. Then he let his feet slide free, his legs dangling. For an instant his grip faltered, and he thought he was going to plummet two stories onto the open ground, landing in full view of the guards. But somehow he held on. Bucking his legs, he swung himself out and away from the chalet and then back in. Another swing built momentum, and as he flew toward the building, he let himself drop. He landed off balance on the slick balcony below, his heels skidding out from beneath him. He hit the balcony flat on his back. Manny was standing on the other side of the sliding glass door right in front of Evan, peering directly at him. Evan's inhale caught in his throat. Then he realized. Manny couldn't see him. The room lights were on, and he was using the glass door for a mirror as he buttoned his shirt. Evan lay perfectly still. Snow fell on the side of his cheek. 2 feet to the glass. 2 feet more to Manny. Manny's mouth twitched to the side as he finished with his shirt, and then he flashed his golden smile at himself and turned away to grab socks off the bed. Evan rolled smoothly back over his shoulders and out of view. The neighboring balcony was within reach. He jumped onto it from the railing. He came down awkwardly, but at least didn't Charlie Brown the landing like last time. The attached room looked empty. He checked the sliding glass door, found it locked. Onto the next balcony, another graceless ballet leap through elegantly falling snow. This slider opened under his touch. He entered a dark bedroom that looked to be a match of his own. Moving swiftly, he crossed to the door, cracked it, and peered out. His vantage showed a clear shot up the hall to the stairwell. Gliding the doorknob forward, he wheeled out, pivoting to check the blind length of hall to the hinge side of the door. He found himself face to face with Nando. 36. A real fighter. Nando's arm was raised. He was in the middle of taking a bite from a power bar. His elbow pinned the butt of the AK-47 slung around his neck, keeping it aimed forward. Before Evan could move on him, he dropped the protein bar and leapt back, raising the gun.
Pare! Right there! Manos! Manos!
Evan did not lift his hands. Nando's eyes darted, his Adam's apple jerking with each inhalation, but his grip looked firm.
This is a predicament, Evan said. You have your cuerno de chivo instead of the beanbag shotgun. I'm the item of value in this equation, not you. If you kill me, what will Rene say? After all his hard work.
Sweat glossed Nando's face. He lowered the tip of the AK, aiming at Evan's thigh.
Careful, Evan said. You hit an artery, I bleed out. Neither of us wants that.
Nando rolled his lips, swallowed. A notion glimmered in his eyes.
Easy solution, he said.
Keeping his trigger hand on the weapon, he fished in his pocket and came out with the shock collar transmitter. He was breathing even harder. Beneath the unhooked top buttons of his shirt, his chest was shiny with sweat.
Now what do you have to say?
You've got the upper hand, Evan said. But look at you. Racing heart rate, nearly hyperventilating. Now look at me. Look at me closely. And ask yourself, do I look scared? Nando wet his lips. Evan said, the next question is, why not? Nando's fist tensed around the transmitter. Nothing happened. He pointed it at Evan, clicked several more times, the whites of his eyes pronounced. Evan tilted his head back, exposing his chin. He'd taken the new trash can liner from the bathroom, folded it over 6 times, and wedged it into place between the metal prods and his skin. The polyethylene plastic band was just thick enough to block the electric shock. The transmitter slipped through Nando's fingers. He brought his hand around to the fore end of the AK. But Evan was already airborne. His body coiled and exploded into a Superman punch, his right leg cycling forward and then pistoning back, whipping his right arm at Nando. His fist crashed against Nando's cheek, snapping the head to the side with a crackle of vertebrae. The narco collapsed in a puddle of limbs as if his spinal cord had been ripped out of him. No sooner had Evan landed than he heard a door open behind him. He spun around to see Manny emerge 2 rooms down the hall.
Shit, Manny said.
He leaned back through the doorway, returned hoisting a shotgun with a neon orange stock. The sling of Nando's AK-47 was tangled around his body. There'd be no time to free the weapon. Evan swept up the handheld transmitter and ran for the stairs. The thump of a flexible baton round vibrated the air. Evan hunched, the beanbag glancing off his shoulder blade and decimating a wall sconce. Behind him, he heard Manny jack the shotgun, chambering another round. Evan slid onto the stairs, the next shot whistling overhead, punching straight through the drywall. The stairs hammered his back, his heels finally jarring into the first landing. Bouncing to his feet, he spun around the newel post and bounded down the next flight, nearly tripping as he spilled into the empty library of the ground floor. Manny's shouts echoed through the stairwell. Various radios crackled to life elsewhere in the chalet. Heavy boots pounded the marble, the guards radiating outward in the building. Their first priority would be locking down the perimeter. So Evan ran the opposite way, toward the heart of the chalet. He passed a closet, a bathroom, nearing the vast living room. A boot squeaked in a room across the hall, and he spun through the opposite doorway, flattening himself to the wall just past the jamb. Gear clanked as the men stepped out into the hall. Evan was close enough to hear them breathing. A radio spit staticky Spanish.
Ven a recoger los perros!
And the boots squeaked into action again, soles pounding away to the front of the chalet. Evan eased out a breath through his teeth, studied the transmitter. He thumbed an offset red button on the side, and the collar released from his neck. He caught it before it could clatter to the floor, then dropped it and the transmitter into the base of a potted fern. balling up the banded plastic bag that had protected his neck, he flung it into a corner. Already he could hear the Doberman's barks echoing off the hard surfaces of the foyer. Then came the scraping of claws against marble as they hurtled up the corridor. Evan ran toward the dining room, hip sliding across the table and banging through the swinging doors to the kitchen. No one was there. His gaze swept the room. Knife block next to the wood-fired oven. Pantry door slightly ajar, showing a sliver of black at the seam. Pasta pot filled with water sitting cold on the stovetop of the center island. Hanging pot rack. The nearest counter held all order of serving supplies. Cupcake liners, black cloth napkins, toothpicks, wads of cheesecloth, towers of fluted ramekins. Rear swinging doors led to the ballroom, but the dogs would be up his back before he'd be able to get through. From the sound of it, they'd reached the living room already. Neither set of swinging doors featured locks. It would be impossible to barricade them against the dogs and do anything else. Pounding paws tapped the parquet floor of the dining room. A crashing of chairs knocked aside. There was no more time. Evan shoved the pasta pot off the stove. It clanged loudly, water spilling out, slicking the tile floor. He leapt across the puddle and yanked open the pantry door, holding it before him, an angled shield. The dogs exploded through the swinging doors, hitting the tile floor at a full gallop. Their paws scrabbled for purchase on the wet floor, their legs splaying, like fawns trying to gain footing on ice. Their snarls dwindled to whines as they rotated into quarter turns, sliding across the wet tile, banging off the angled door and ricocheting neatly into the pantry. Evan slammed the door, trapping them inside. Snatching a jar from the nearby counter, he flicked up a toothpick, wedged it into the keyhole in the pantry doorknob, and snapped off a splinter of wood, jamming the lock. The dogs howled and scratched, but the door held. Already Evan could hear their handlers closing in, boots smashing through the wreckage of the dining room chairs. They were steps away. He looked around. If he ran through the rear doors, he'd be an easy target in the bare expanse of the ballroom. The pantry was spoken for. The island provided scant cover. There was nowhere to hide. The two handlers burst through the doors and scanned the empty kitchen over the tops of their shotguns. The first man gestured at his partner to check the ballroom. He waited, sweating, while his partner crept across and knuckled one of the swinging doors open. He turned back, shook his head.
Nada, Angel.
Then he did a double take at the knife block, pointing at the empty slot. Both men's mouths firmed. The dogs howled and scraped at the inside of the pantry door. Angel walked over and jiggled the locked doorknob. Then he opened a cabinet next to the pantry and slid the key off the bottom shelf. He tried to insert it into the keyhole, but it wouldn't go. Crouching, he studied the doorknob, taking his eyes off his partner, who was walking backward along the rear counter, his raised shotgun rotating between the sets of doors. He faced outward, sliding one hip along the marble ledge as he passed before the mouth of the wood-fired oven. As he eased by, two arms appeared in the dark chamber of the oven behind him, reaching slowly through the bricked arch. A boning knife glinted in one fist. The handler kept on unsuspectingly, even as the hands crept forward on either side of his head. The arms seized him in a lightning strike. Evan braced the handler's head forward so the slicing motion of the blade wouldn't nick his own forearm once it passed across the throat. It did not. He crawled out of the dome of the oven, cradling the still shuddering body. He kept the head tilted forward so the lungs wouldn't make a sucking sound through the slit and alert Angel, who was still squatting by the pantry with his back turned. Sliding soundlessly off the counter, Evan lowered the corpse to the floor. Angel rose, frustrated.
La pinche cosa está atascada.
He turned. A moment of horror. He shouted for help even as he raised the shotgun. Evan ducked behind the island before the shot, realizing too late that Angel had wisely aimed not at him, but at the pot rack hanging above. The crash was thunderous. Pans pelted down over Evan's upraised arms, knocking the knife from his grasp. He spilled onto his back. Angel dove across the island, gliding on his substantial belly, soaring off the end at Evan,